It's 7:06 on AM 600 KOGO, San Diego's news and talk station, The Jack Rice Show. And as we've been talking about throughout the evening, this is our weekly segment of Reader Radio, where we look at San Diego, well, through the eyes in some ways of Barbarella. That's right, the author of Diary of a Diva and the San Diego Weekly Reader. Thanks for coming in studio again. Are you kidding? This is always great. So let's dive in. Talk to me about what's coming up. And it actually comes up tomorrow morning when it hits the streets again, the San Diego Weekly Reader. What are you bringing to us?
Well, tonight we have two very interesting guests. Our first is going to be Matthew Lacona, who is our church reviewer. Every week he has a column called Sheep and Goats, in which he reviews churches the way other people review restaurants. And his cover story this week that comes out tomorrow is called Church on Sunday? If not, did you ever wonder why people do? Now, this is interesting for me. I was raised a Catholic, and now I'm an atheist. So I'm really curious to ask Matthew a couple of questions about this story. And I believe he's on with us now.
Matthew, with us right now? Fantastic. Matthew, thanks for joining us very much. Go ahead, Barbarella.
Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
All right. So I was reading your story. First of all, will you tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this story about why people who go to church go to church?
Well, it started with sort of the principal subject of the story, who's Father John Braun, who is a priest with the Orthodox Church. And he wasn't always a priest with the Orthodox Church. He actually started, he's the son of a Presbyterian minister, and at one point was the national field director for the Campus Crusade for Christ, which is an enormous evangelical organization.
Right.
And it's always interesting when somebody in Christianity abdicates a position of power, and it's not because of a sexual scandal. So here he was in this, you know, he'd reached to some extent the top of the mountain. He was giving lectures to 6,000 and 7,000 college kids a night, and he was, you know, succeeding, and everything was growing, and it's just what the church model is supposed to do. And he ends up a priest with a denomination that has a very, very small representation in the United States, and it's kind of in a lot of ways the opposite of the whole evangelical model. There's a lot of focus on liturgy. You've got these priests in robes with their incense and their chants, and it all feels very ancient and not at all like kind of modern American Christianity. And so I was curious about how he got from where he was to where he is. It's always, you know, when someone who is famous, who is a big deal in their pond, ends up just leaving that and going to something much smaller.
Right. So you have why this one person decided to go to a smaller church with more, you know, almost one-on-one sort of thing. But what about why people go to his church?
Well, that's what, and so it got me thinking about kind of the larger question, because I was seeing things going church to church week after week. I was hearing pastors say things that had me kind of curious.
There was one quote, sorry to interrupt you, but a really great quote in your story where you said one preacher actually said, "It's not in church that we practice Christianity. It's out there on the street." And you said he was trying to talk himself out of a job.
Right.
I was wondering why.
He even called himself, he compared himself. He didn't say, "I'm an entertainer," but he compared himself to the entertainment. He was what got you fired up and excited about being a Christian. But he didn't want, I think he also said, we've confused going to church with being the church. And, you know, Christianity, as preached in the Gospels, is a movement much more than it's a Sunday morning social club. You know?
Matthew, did you see a contrast with that? I mean, with what you saw there versus so many of the other churches you've gone into, because, I mean, you do this regularly now.
The contrast between
what you heard there, this idea that, you know, you need to do this out in the street. This isn't something you do on a Sunday from 11 to 12 or from 9 to 10, which is much different than frequently, at least what I hear.
Well, what's interesting is it, in some ways, he was coming out and saying what I saw as an operative dynamic in a whole bunch of other churches, where they'd spend a fair chunk of the service talking about what they were going to be doing when they got together in their small groups. And these small groups were the ones who were actually doing kind of street ministry or working to, you know, clean up a neighborhood or manning
a
soup kitchen.
In that case, would you say it's like a town hall meeting?
It started to have kind of that feeling. And Father Braun said that at one point even he thought that he regarded church at one point as a lecture with music. You know, you had the kind of music at the outset to get you, you know, the blood pumping. It's Sunday morning. You get all excited. You know, you shout your praise to Jesus. And then you you know, here's something that makes you think, and then you go out and actually do the business of being a Christian. And I was down in the South Bay, and there was a pastor. He pointed to a couple of teenagers outside the church and said, if we weren't doing the ministry we're doing, if we weren't going down to Mexico and bringing clothes and food to orphans down there, they wouldn't be here on Sunday morning. They have no use for this kind of traditional, you know, let's get together on Sunday morning.
But if they're doing the community thing anyway, why do they have a use for it? I mean, I see what Jack means with the contradiction in that you're doing the being a Christian in the community. Why then go back to the church to check in?
Well, interestingly, I mean, Father Braun, when he was with Campus Crusade for Christ, he kind of saw the need for churches in that the Campus Crusade for Christ didn't have a church, didn't have Sunday gatherings. And what his experience was that when these college kids would get into, they would commit their lives to Jesus, and they would want to serve the Lord, and they would want to have that kind of charism in their lives. But he said if they didn't have a church community where they gathered regularly, they didn't tend to do very well 5-10 years down the road. And I mean, there's a kind of basic sociological.
So they have to check in order to continue doing it, almost like reporting to class, where you get your report card and say, what have you done this month? Have you been a good community member?
I'm not sure it's so much a checkup where you're like giving a report to the boss as where you're drawing strength from the sense of actually being in a community. I mean, Christ is forever talking about, you know, building the kingdom of God, not being these individual, you know, warriors or missionaries. He really, the vision he paints of paradise is very much a community, and I think that gets at something that they experience the need for. They find a use in gathering together in terms of building up their own strength and their own conviction.
Matthew, thinking about this contrast between this Campus Crusade for Christ and sort of how it's done with lots of rock music and then you kind of have this very fiery sermon versus what you see at this church now, which is a completely different approach, it would almost seem that this would be a rejection of that, that all of a sudden, you know, that was about lots of fire and maybe not that much of substance. This is about something else. Is that a fair conclusion?
I don't want to put words in Father Braun's mouth.
Did you ask him that question?
When I talked to him, I did ask him to do a lot of contrasting between his experience of religion then and now, and he stressed that what he really discovered, you know, he was not rejecting what he had grown up with, but rather he found what he thought to be a fuller expression. He said, you know, my experience of the Protestant world that I was in was that it had a lot of good things, but it didn't have the fullness.
He wanted a little bit of both, it seemed like.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, where he is now, I mean, for him, the point of gathering on Sunday was not simply that communal gathering for drawing strength with another, but he really discovered in the Orthodox liturgy a kind of direct communion with the divine found not only to be historically correct, and that, it was interesting when he started his search to figure out where he was going to end up, he went back in history, which made a certain amount of sense to me since Christianity supposedly started with a particular historical event. So he said, I want to get back to as close as I can to, you know, that early history of the church and sort of trace how things progress from there.
It's interesting what you say. It's almost like, so you go to church to commune with God. You said the divinity, but you go to the community to be a Christian. So that's almost where you go to in a temple, sort of speak to the divinity or hear the word,
I think that he would say, and again, I hesitate to put too
of
many...
Of course, of course. Well, in your opinion.
But I think he would say that what we're doing when we go to church is as close as we're going to get to heaven on earth, that in heaven there is that kind of direct communion with God, but also that communion with all those who are sharing in that presence. I mean, it's constantly, you know, the New Jerusalem is painted as a city. You know, it's a bunch of people living together, only it's now under the law of love.
Matthew, nationwide we have seen these mega churches rise up, and that is essentially the new organization of faith. It seems to be for a lot of different people. That seems far more reminiscent of this Campus Crusade for Christ than it does of this more historically, I don't want to say accurate, but at least referenced church. It's a much different game.
I think you're right.
And I say game with respect for the people who have that faith.
Right, and even within those mega churches, you'll see a lot of emphasis on home study groups, on these small groups of where it's four or five people, because they'll all acknowledge that you can't have the kind of personal communion and the kind of individual ministry of brother to brother, sister to sister, that the Gospels always talk about when there's 50,000 of you listening to one guy preach and a band play. People who are critical of that will say, well, Jesus never commanded people to get together on Sunday and do that.
No, they just wanted to follow him. Well, Matthew, I thank you for being on with us tonight, and I invite everybody to read the in-depth story in the Reader that's out tomorrow, Matthew's cover story about church on Sunday. If not, did you ever wonder why people do? Thanks a lot, Matthew.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's a certain piece of San Diego. Now, stay with us, because, again, coming up next, we're going to go to a different piece of San Diego, and this is
very
much,
different.
Much, much different. This is an African-American surfer out at OB, and what happens. It's sort of a first-person story. You're not going to want to miss this, because this is much, and I mean it, much, much different. Barbarella joins me right here in studio. This is your weekly segment of Reader Radio and The Jack Rice Show on San Diego's News and Talk Station, AM 600 KOGO. AM 723 on AM 600 KOGO, San Diego's News and Talk Station. We continue with our weekly segment of Reader Radio with Barbarella joining me in studio, looking at San Diego. And as I promised, this is a much different angle. There are many pieces of San Diego, but one piece which I've always been fascinated by is the surfer piece. But it isn't quite that simple, is it, Barbarella?
No. Surfers in OB, which would probably declare themselves different than surfers in PB or Imperial Beach or anywhere else. We have a section in the Reader called Neighborhood Stringer Stories, where average people from different neighborhoods can send in stories of their first-person accounts. And Tim Harper wrote a story called Surf Nazi at the Jetty that's out in the Reader tomorrow, about an incident that happened to him while trying to surf in OB. And we have Tim with us, I believe. I have some questions for him.
How you doing, Tim? Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, Tim. So I read your story, and it's very fascinating. And just to let people know the gist of it, you were out surfing by the jetty in OB, and somebody approached you and said, get off my wave. An incident began, which ended with you punching him and then later getting to the beach and having the cops called. Now, what people might not know is that you're an African American, and later on there were some racial slurs made. But I have some questions for you. First of all, would you give us a brief synopsis of the incident again, and then I have a question for you.
Yeah, the incident happened about maybe 2 to 3 weeks ago over at Ocean Beach. A familiar break for surfers called Dog Beach. There's a jetty over there. It's a point break, mostly with sandbar breaks, and it's a right. I've been surfing here in California for the last 12 years. I'm from Texas, from Corpus Christi. And I've never really had any problem with any locals. I've had a few guys, occasional arguments, but this guy seemed to come out of nowhere and try to claim territory.
How did he try to claim the territory?
Just basically saying that, I'm here, I've been here, I'm a local here, I grew up here, and just basically trying to own the rights to waves. Waves don't have names written on them whatsoever unless you're riding them.
Right. And now in the story, just before you punched him, you say that he made a move and then you punched him. At the time, he had not called you any names yet, right? He just said, get off the wave. And I want to know, what was that move he made that made you punch him?
He had threatened to take the nose of his surfboard and try to stab me in the eye with it. And I'm a combat veteran, so I basically went on the defensive when I heard that. So when he made a move for the board, my instincts were to react. So I protected myself.
Tim, before you get more into this story, I'm curious. One of the things you just said was that there is no name on any wave. But is that true? It seems to me, when I talk to people who are very hardcore surfers, they work particular jobs so they can surf in particular places at particular times. This is their life. Guess what?
Right.
To those people, and you might be one of them, there are names on those waves, and they're their names.
And it's very fair name. Of course, there's people who are amateurs, those people are professional. And I've always given the respect. I've been all the way up to Pipeline. I've surfed Backdoor. Not when it was maxing out, but I gave people the respect and the right of way to the wave. That's just my own courtesy as a person, mm-hmm. whether it's a wave or not. If you're at a stoplight and you want somebody else to go first, you give somebody else. It's a common courtesy.
But you have to realize that there is a culture to surfing that if people don't understand that, they don't even know what you're talking about right now. The
right.
idea that you would actually have to give way because they have the right of way. What are you talking
right.
about?
Right.
There are no stop signs. There are no stoplights. There are no lines. There's nothing.
Right.
So had you given way at first, and then he still tried to push you out?
Well, it wasn't that. I had caught a wave way before he had even been out in the water. And I guess he saw me surfing these couple of different waves, and all of a sudden he came out of the water and just all of a sudden flying like, that's it. That's the last wave we're going to catch. We're not catching any more waves. I'm like, first of all, we're not in the competition. I've surfed competitions before back in the 80s. So I know about being lined up and being in priority. But even if I'm in priority, if a wave comes along and somebody else has a better chance of getting it, I would give it up to them and not have to argue about it. But when somebody's all of a sudden just claiming the whole entire beach, or that area, nobody can do that.
Did you feel, now I understand that after the cops came, there were some racial slurs made, which is really unfortunate.
Actually,
do you feel that this was a racial thing?
Well, there was actually, the racial slurs were made in the water.
Oh, they were? Okay, I didn't gather that.
I think it would have been 10 times worse. It was something that they had told me that, yeah, he was making some gestures and slurs while you weren't looking, where you didn't hear it.
Oh.
And then when I got to the beach later on, when I followed him back into the beach, you know, he had called me and said, you want to fight in the water? Let's go to the beach.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm like, whatever, you know, in the water, in the beach doesn't really make a difference.
Right. So, well, let me do this, Tim. We're running out of time here, so I want to say
okay.
two things. I want to say, first of all, thank you so much for being on with us. Second of all, everybody, read the story. Plus, there are tons of comments about people, both online and in the paper, about what other people think about this incident. So thank you so much, Tim. And everybody, read Tim's story and enjoy. I hope you catch the next wave.
Oh, I
okay.
will.
All right.
Tim, thank you so much. Barbarella, by the way, this is what I love about this segment is that it gives us little snippets, little tiny pieces of our town.
Right.
And again, if you're not a surfer, trust me, there's a whole life that's out
these
there that's going
subcultures.
On. We never even know.
Yeah, subcultures everywhere.
Well, I love that. And of course, I look forward to next week's. And the San Diego Weekly Reader hits the streets tomorrow, so we'll be looking for that. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you, Jack.
It was great. We have a lot more coming up. You have seen this, by the way. You see the pirate attack, the latest pirate attack off of Somalia? That's right. This is the 66th. The coast of Somalia is the length of the eastern seaboard of the United States. The entire region that it covers, 1.1 million square miles. How do you possibly deal with that? We'll find out from an expert next. Stay with us on The Jack Rice Show. This is San Diego's News and Talk Station, AM 600 KOGO. On AM 600 KOGO, San Diego's News and Talk Station. By the way, if you have missed any part of this broadcast or any of our previous broadcasts, go to KOGO.com, click on the Jack Rice page, and we have a podcast of every show up there, and you can listen. By the way, even today's show will be up there by about 9:30 tonight, so you can listen back if you missed a little piece of it and wanted to hear something more. If you have turned on the news in the last 5 or 6 hours, if you have opened up any paper, if you have gone on the internet, the number one story that people are talking about right now is piracy. Piracy and what it means off of the coast of Somalia. And what I have been hearing over and over is, why don't you just get these guys? And so I started digging into this. And here's one of the things that I found out. If you look at Somalia in general, the coast of Somalia is roughly the equivalent of the eastern seaboard of the United States in terms of size. According to the U.S. Navy, it would take 61 ships to control the shipping route in the Gulf of Aden alone, which is just a fraction of the 1.1 million square miles. You heard me, 1.1 million square miles where the pirates have operated. A U.S.-backed international anti-piracy coalition currently has anywhere between 12 and 16 ships patrolling the region at any one time. So how do you do it? What can happen next? That's why we need to turn to somebody, and we turn to Eric Wertheim. He's a respected military analyst. He writes Combat Fleets column and Proceedings, but again, he is the author of the book Combat Fleets of the World. This is considered by navies around the globe to be the Bible of international sea power. Eric, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Everybody is watching this thing. I mean, maybe it's the concept of piracy that many people don't even believe that it exists, but we have been hearing about this over and over and over till just recently, and I guess it was this last December, the Bush administration sought and won the UN Security Council authorization to expand international naval operations to go after these guys. I mean, how hard is this?
This is a very complicated problem because we see it in, we've seen the problem of piracy happen for hundreds of years, of course, and it's something that comes and goes in generational waves. And up until about 5 or 6 years ago, the real problem wasn't off Somalia, it was off Indonesia and Malaysia in an area called the Straits of Malacca. And that was a very constrained area and was very vulnerable to piracy. And that is an area now that has seen a remarkable drop in piracy, and there's been some steps that they've taken, and I'm happy to share some of those with you, some of the things as we look to Somalia that might hold some clues for where we can go.
Well, let's talk about that. In light of this 17,000-ton Maersk Alabama that was taken along with some 20 U.S. nationals, the crew apparently were able to get this ship back, gain control of the ship, but the pirates were able to escape with the captain, another U.S. American. So I think this is the first time this has ever happened that I'm aware of, at least off of the coast of Somalia. So this is a very big question on what we do. I mean, talk to me about what was going on in Southeast Asia,
yes,
and then we'll see if we can translate.
It's a remarkable story in both places, because what happened was that we were seeing a tremendous number of these hijackings in the area around the Straits of Malacca. And then, starting in 2006 and 2007, they started dropping very dramatically. And it was because Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore started patrolling, increasing the amounts of patrols they were doing. And then they started also looking to attack where the pirates were operating out of, the villages in the area. And then they started working with shippers to make the shipping companies and those aboard ships more cautious of what was going on. And then finally, amazingly, the last thing was that the tsunami that happened in the area cleared out the area and allowed economic growth to begin, giving these places jobs. And that comes to one of the biggest problems that's happening in Somalia. It's a lawless country with rampant unemployment and no money. And so that's really at the root of this. So a military action in any of this stuff, as successful as it can be, is only going to deal with one of the symptoms. And somehow the international community is going to have to deal with this.
Well, I contemplate what you described for Southeast Asia. We think about what Singapore is doing, Indonesia, Malaysia, those areas, and those are not failed states. The problem with Somalia, they haven't had an active government that actually controlled the country for, let's see, I guess it would be in excess of 20 years now.
Yeah, they have absolutely right.
They have no centralized authority. The ability to take out 1, 10, 50, or 100 guys only means there's going to be 1, 10, 50, 100, or 1,000 guys who will be right behind them.
Yes, as many ways to look at the glass half full, there's as many to look at it half empty. And I think one of the scary things about this is the most of the shipping corporations felt that they were safe. Beginning, they were saying stay 50 nautical, 50 miles, a little more than 50 miles offshore. Then after that it happened, they said keep moving off. Then it became 100, 200 miles. And this took place over 200 miles from the shore because they're using mother ships. The pirates are actually taking larger ships, going out and trying to capture these ships.
Well, again, as I understand it, according to the U.S. Navy, this happened about 280 miles, 450 kilometers off the coast. And it's pretty extraordinary, especially when we find out that the merchant ships, they're only allowed to do certain things. As I understand it, merchant crews aren't supposed to fight pirates. They're allowed to use high-pressure hoses, and that's it, nothing more.
Well, there are some things they can do. One of the things, for instance, are sonic sound cannons, which are very high-power audio noises that can divert and make things very uncomfortable. The problem is these things are nothing against rocket-propelled grenades, rocket launchers, and small arms fire. So these are the things they're up against, and unless you're a Navy warship, you're going to be outgunned.
Eric Wertheim is my guest again, a well-respected military analyst, the author of the book Combat Fleets of the World. This is the Bible for international organizations and navies looking at international sea power. The problem with this, Eric, of course, is that I'm pretty sure these pirate boats, and these are boats that they're using, are probably not listed in your book.
No, we do include some small ships. These are not registered to any government because, of course, Somalia doesn't have a government. So you can't even negotiate with a government. You can't impose any kind of sanctions. And the amazing thing about this is the ship that was hijacked, that the pirates attempted to take, was actually bringing aid to Africa.
So,
this was actually bringing aid to the region to help feed hungry people.
So what do we do? Again, I have seen some people say, we go in and we bomb them. We go in and we attack them. And anytime anybody says Somalia, honestly, in this country, the only experience frequently that people have, although there have been many people who have immigrated from Somalia, live in certain parts of the country. Other than that, and dare I say it, it's Black Hawk Down. That's it. That's what people remember.
Yep, there you're absolutely right. There are dangers here, and I think one of the key things we have to remember is there's some positive things that are going on in that right now there are ships from China, India, Japan, Russia, the U.S., NATO. These are all in the area, and one of the things we can do, and we are doing, is developing sea lanes in to be able to escort and make safe havens for these shipping platforms. The problem is, though, that the areas that we had seen the pirates operating in, they have been moving around. Much as if you ever study law enforcement, those types of things, the same thing happens. So you have drugs, prostitution, certain crime. When you saturate an area with law enforcement, they just move to another area.
So does that mean that there is no alternative, that this is not going to work? Well, we're saber-rattle and say, oh, we're going to do something, but the problem is there is really nothing that can be done here. I mean, honestly, there can be nothing that's really can be done effectively, I mean.
Well, the core is being able to set up a stable government in Somalia. If that's able to happen, and when there was a stable government for a brief period of time during the second half of 2006, we actually saw the pirate attacks drop dramatically. And that's an important thing to remember. The hard part is it's very difficult to set up any kind of government here. That's what we're faced with, and these are the things, not only the naval activities, which are essential, that's the equivalent of the law enforcement, but you have to look at the deeper roots of the crime, and that's really what, in a lot of ways, this is a crime.
But do you really see the American people, the people of the world, stepping up saying, here's what we're going to do. There are pirates attacking from Somalia, so what we're going to do is see if we can help establish a Somali government. I'm sorry, man. I just don't buy that for a second.
I
think you're right, but I don't think we're willing to do it.
Well, the problem right now is that the cost of the Somali pirates is not high enough to have the incentive. Once you get to the point where the cost of the pirates that they're taking out on our economy, on the economies of the world, are so high, then things will happen. And they're only starting to reach that point. So we're really only in the infancy of solving this problem right now.
How many ships are we talking about? How big of a problem is this?
Well, that's another huge issue, is that no one's able to really put their finger on an exact number because a lot of things go unreported. And I've actually seen figures on the cost of piracy around the world as low. Just recently I saw that the low end was $60 to $70 million for the entire world, all the way up to $16 billion in a year. So that shows you the figures are all over the place, and the numbers of attacks, there's just not a great way of recording this. And right now, this is, in a lot of ways, an international crime scene, and you have a bunch of different departments trying to deal with it. And right now, the U.S. Navy is looking out for its own, and the Bainbridge, USS Bainbridge, a destroyer, has arrived on the scene, and it's going to be some very interesting developments during the next few hours and days.
The only thing I'm thinking of is I recall when these pirates actually attacked a warship, and I think the Brits sent out commandos, and if I'm not mistaken, they killed everybody.
It was the French. The French did a very interesting thing when they hijacked a ship, and once they got their ransom, they left, and the French attacked tracked down those pirates, and not only some of them were attacked, some of them were captured and actually brought back to France and are tried in the courts. And that's another problem that we're facing, trying these people in the courts. Where do you try them? Because Somalia, of course, doesn't have a government, and they're not really set up yet. So we're dealing with, we're talking about maybe we should try them in Kenya. Should we have an international court? These are all things that, because we're so much in the early infancy, We're just beginning to see this. And we really don't have answers yet.
Eric, I want you to stay with me, because coming up next, what I'd like to talk about is if there is one other alternative. If we can't have all of these various ships in place, again, what the Navy said is it would take 61 ships to control the shipping route in the Gulf of Aden alone, but that only touches the area that these pirates actually work. Is there another alternative? Could we start arming merchant crews to defend themselves? Let's talk about that. Eric Wertheim is my guest, an expert, a military analyst who looks at piracy and what it means. Stay with us. This is the Jack Rice Show on San Diego's News and Talk Station, AM 600 KOGO. You're listening to AM 600 KOGO, San Diego's News and Talk Station. If you've missed any of the broadcast tonight or any of the programs, go to KOGO.com and click on my page, the Jack Rice page, and you can listen to the podcast. You can listen to one little piece of it, and you just keep waiting, and you'll get to that point. And even tonight's should be up by about 9:30 or so. Gregory will make sure that it's up there so you can listen to it at your leisure. Not a bad thing. Now let's get back to Eric Wertheim as we look at piracy off the coast of Somalia. All of a sudden, this is not something that happens far away. Yeah, well, it is far away, but it involves 20 U.S. nationals, including one who is still in the hands of the pirates themselves. Eric, again, thanks for staying with me. Let's turn to this other question. The merchant crews themselves aren't supposed to fight the pirates themselves, and we mentioned some alternatives. Should we arm them? Should they be allowed to fight the pirates, or is that a really bad idea?
I think that from a practical standpoint, it's a very good idea. The problem is, anytime you deal with practicality in today's world, you have to deal with the lawyers and the legal issues. And you have to deal with the fact that these people are paying ransoms, and for the most part, things are handled safely. And what's happened now is, just until very recently, the ransoms were really in the tens of thousands to maybe the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they've only now recently, in the most recent months, started to go to the millions. And so, as I've said before, we're at the point, we're at a crossroads now, where we're starting to see that it's worth it to start arming these people. It may be worth it, I should say. The dilemma is, what's happening to these crews? The other problem is, though, if you're dealing with an oil tanker, you're dealing with hazardous material, and you start arming the crews, these are sailors. Their job is not to fight. These are merchant sailors, and so we have to remember that they didn't join up to fight off pirates, and so we're asking a lot of these people. You know, my feeling is it should be their call. They shouldn't have to be forced to do this.
Well, one option might be like air marshals. I mean, if we think about what we have seen in the airlines, you might have a couple of people. I guess the real problem is if you have 25 or 30 pirates come rolling at you, you have two air marshals or the equivalent on a super tanker, something that's 17,000 tons. That strikes me as insignificant, inconsequential, and irrelevant.
Well, I actually think that if you were to have some 50 caliber guns or 7.62 M60 type machine guns, you could go a long way toward defending that ship because it makes it less than a suitable target. Just like you try to protect your house by putting a burglar alarm and he goes to the next house. That's what you're trying to do, make a ship unattractive. That's really one alternative. Another alternative that is possible and that they're working to do is put the shipping into safe lanes. This is a very helpful way of doing it, very similar to escorting. You now have safely patrolled lanes. The danger of the safely patrolled lanes issue is if you don't have enough warships and patrol aircraft and patrol craft to patrol those zones, they then become kill zones for the bad guys. So then all of a sudden you have the pirates in the candy store. So the danger of the kill zones, the plus part is it's very attractive. The danger is if you don't patrol it well, it's even worse.
Then are we going to see enough funding? Because obviously the numbers are substantial, and now they're starting to get serious because of the costs. Where are we going to see not just the Americans, because this is a world issue. The Chinese are having the same problems. In fact, the Chinese were, I believe, the last ship that was taken.
Yeah, and the Chinese have actually, it's an amazing story, they haven't deployed a naval force overseas in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And this is now, they've now renewed their commitment to this program, and they're in the game with NATO and Russia and India, and this is a new thing for them. And so we see an incredible amount of international cooperation, but no one really knows what to do next because we're in completely uncharted territory. You can't just, like in the old days, you could just start shooting at a ship if you thought it was a pirate and just grab the people and hang them. You can't do that anymore for legal reasons, for international law. And then the amazing thing is in the old days, if you made an agreement with a pirate and they reneged, you could just go bomb their port and just start unloading cannon into it. You just can't do that anymore. International law doesn't allow the kind of actions that took place hundreds of years ago.
An incredible story. Again, we'll continue to watch this one. Thankfully that 19 of the U.S. nationals were recovered, but one is still in the hands of the pirates. Eric, thank you very much for the time this evening.
Always glad to be here.
Eric Wertheim, again, a military analyst, the author of Combat Fleets of the World. Tell you what, this is one of those stories that everybody is talking about, and now you really understand what's really going on. I'll be back tomorrow night. Make sure you join me right after 6, the Jack Rice Show on San Diego's News and Talk Station, AM 600 KOGO.